So good morning. So I will try to give you more of what we understand and what we don't understand of the about the EC's genome. And I will try to ask a question: how genes are can a new gene can be formed? Just to summarize what I've said yesterday. Here is a list of yeast that for which we are studying. And yesterday we spent a lot of time on the duplicated yeast and post-duplication gene loss, map reshuffling, speciation, and the like. But a number of other things in this field. In particular, and I will discuss a little bit today, for this other group of yeast, which is very not related to this one, there are other phenomena such as tandem gene family expansion and genomic mosaicism. So I will discuss that a little bit today. Here, there are other things, including fusion of different non-coding RNA molecules to make polycystronic transcripts. But I would like to first to start with the following. These yeast here clearly belong to a unique group, which is called in the jargon Saccharomycetaceae or whatever. This is not a family in the botanical part of in botanical sense, but they are clearly linked to each other. These five yeast here, we spend a great deal of effort to study these five yeast because they are clearly non-duplicated and they are clearly linked to these duplicated yeast. So we call them in our jargon protoploid because, as you see, the tree they are not a unique phylum, but they are not. Their definition is that they are from the same group as these, but they are not duplicated as these. So I will start with that because when we were discussing yesterday of the synteny conservation is true for this group of yeast. But when you jump from this group of yeast to this one, or this one, then the synteny disappears. Okay.
You jump down there, you're talking about many hundreds of millions of
yeast. Yeah. They're extremely, there's a big divide here, and big divide here. Yeah. Okay. And this one here, as I said yesterday, they're probably 100 million year old. Maybe 200, maybe 300, who knows? Something of this order. Yeah. Okay, first, before I go into that, let me summarize a little bit how we annotate the genome, because there are many yeast genomes in the databases. They are not all the same. Our yeast, we have now nine of them. Our yeast are complete sequences, and they're final DNA sequences. So you have in the computer one chromosome equal one config, which is not always the case. In many yeast, you have one chromosome equal many configs because they haven't been completely finalized. So we work with that. We annotate them by a model prediction, protein coding genes, tRNA intron, and so forth. We run a protein coding gene association against PSSM comparison with a known previously known protein family, and then we manually inspect all of the gene model annotation. So after that, we believe we have a reasonably well annotated full genome sequence for this yeast. Okay. The results, just brief, short introduction. Result: numerical results are shown here. Here are the duplicated group, here is the five protoploid, and here are the two outgroups, the distantly related one. And you see that this group here started from 6 to 8 chromosomes. They have, after duplication, they have twice as many, roughly, as you might expect. Genome size slightly increased, genome size about 10 megabase for the yeast, about 20% more for those. Gene number coding from protein about 5,000 for those, slightly more for those, as we were discussing yesterday. tRNA genes about 200, same number here. Non-coding RNA genes as shown here. These groups, these two yeast here are clearly outgroup. Okay, their genomes. This one is about the same size as this. This one is twice as large as this one. There are more genes. This one has even a very large number of tRNA genes. Yarovialli politica has more tRNA genes than human genome has tRNA genes for reasons we don't really understand. Okay. This is just a broad idea of the figures that we have. As anybody else, we put predicted proteomes, roughly 49,000 proteins in total for the 9 genomes, put them in the computer, run a BLAST Smith-Waterman sequence alignment, and then classify them using tribe clustering. And at the end, this is published, at the end we have almost 8,000 protein family from the 49,000 proteins of these 9 yeast. When we look at... Okay. When we look at the distribution of these protein families across the 9 species shown here, some of them are ubiquitous. I mean, they are found in all species. Some of them are specific to one lineage or another. And there's other combination as shown here. What you see immediately from this group of Saccharomycetaceae, all of them here, the non-duplicated one and the duplicated one, they have the same figure of ratio of ubiquitous protein family and lineage-specific families. They have roughly two-thirds of their genome made of ubiquitous protein family, roughly 10-15%, which are specific to one lineage or another. When we go to this outgroup, of course, situation is quite different. The genome is made of about half of the genome is ubiquitous protein family, and more than a quarter of the genome is lineage-specific family corresponding to this lineage or this lineage, as you might expect. So things fall as you reasonably might expect here. Just as a matter of introduction, we were interested to know what are the function of the ubiquitous protein family of these yeast. And the way we did that was from our classification, we went to look for the Saccharomyces cerevisiae gene when they are present, because this is the one for which we have data, functional data. And it was taken from SGD, Saccharomyces cerevisiae genome database. And this is a Go term for biological processes for the Saccharomyces cerevisiae genes, which are classified among ubiquitous protein families. Okay, and you see, for example, that 90% of them classified as ribosome biogenesis and assembly, 90% of them are among the ubiquitous family, which is not a big surprise. You might expect that protein synthesis is the most conserved process, biological process. At the opposite end, you will see that functions such as conjugation, meiosis, sporulation, everything involved in sex, is not very conserved among the yeast, but 50% of the Saccharomyces cerevisiae genes with this label, with this functional label, only half of them are conserved in the ubiquitous family, because the yeast have lost this type of function. This is what you might, this is what we expect, because we know that they do sex in a variety of fashion. And you will see all of the other types of function as shown here. Most of the central functions, such as RNA metabolic process and so forth, they are extremely conserved among the ubiquitous family, as people would believe. Now, this is a matter of introduction. Now, I'd like to discuss some synthetic block. This is the view that we have when we compare two members of the protoploid families of yeast. This is, for example, zygote Saccharomyces roxy compared to Cluvermyces thermotolerans. This is, each bar here is one chromosome. They are placed next to each other according to number. Same here, and the classical dot plot diagonals. And what you immediately see here is that, in fact, the diagonals are short and they are dispersed. Therefore, they are synthetic blocks, but they are not large synthetic blocks. You don't find a chromosome of one species which would be exactly identical to the chromosome of the next. This is not what we find. We find a lot of reshuffling. For these two, which are the two closest one we have found, Clunas thermotolerans and Escuveri, here you start to see pieces in which one third or one quarter of the chromosome of one species is conserved in the other. Same here and same here and so forth. So it just gives you an idea of that. When we compute the numbers here, this is all 10 pairwise comparison for the 5 protoploid yeast, plus one comparison with one of them against an outside group, against the Debariomyces group. And what you see here from this number, the number of synthetic blocks identified by this calculation, for this pair here, we find 84 of them, 84 of them, okay. And they have a mean size of 59 genes and a maximum size of 283 genes. So the longest synthetic block is 283 genes. I think it is this one here, if I'm correct. The mean size is almost 60 genes, okay? This is a pair of two species which are the closer in terms of synthetic. For all of the other comparisons, we have about 200 blocks, sometimes 300, as you can see here. And the maximum number of genes in synthetic block is of the order of 120, 150, something like that. And the mean size is of the order of 22, 15, and so on. Which is this figure here. When we go for an outside group, such as Debariomyces anseni, and the same would be true for every other comparison, you see that the mean size is reduced to about 9 genes, maximum 20 genes. And if I had put another outgroup, such as Yarrowviale politica, it would be even shorter. The mean size would be of the order of 1 or 2 genes, and the maximum size would be of the order of 5 or 10 genes. Okay?
Is there any tendency for synteny blocks to be
conserved?
Is there any tendency for synteny blocks to be conserved in the sense that, let's take one of the big ones in this picture, so there are some 280 genes there. That's same genes tend to be.
It's a good question. We have. I will show the. Okay, then. This person here is a graduate student, Thomas Roland, is working with Beno Frikowski in collaboration with us. Also. And he has recalculated that for the 5. The pair I've shown you is these two. Okay, this is the two closest pair. Okay, if I extend to this one or to this one of these, you will see that the 289 or something will be a little bit reduced, but not completely reduced. So it is still there. Okay, so this guy here is trying to reconcile the synteny block for the 5 protoploids. Okay. This is what he's trying to do right now. And there is some blocks for the 5 protoploid, which are of the order of 80, 90 genes. Okay. When you go to these two here, of course they vanish because of the whole genome duplication. And if you include the outgroup, then everything disappears. Okay. So this is just what is part of his PhD work, in which he has measured the size of synteny block, which what is just on the previous slide, showing this is the pair which is the most, this one here, these two, with an average of about 40 or close to 50 genes. As you see, they are very long blocks, about 200 as shown here. And you will see the next pair between these two will be actually this one. And this is the blue and the red curve which are here giving the largest number of synthetic blocks. All of the other pairwise comparisons are more or less identical, not exactly identical, but of the same type.
These synthetic blocks just jump across all the different chromosomes.
Yeah. It is as if you take one chromosome of one, you will find members in all chromosomes of the other, and vice versa. we don't have any white. Yeah, there is one here. There is one. Okay, so we have one white square. So we have a few, but not many. Chromosomes of each species are represented in almost every chromosome of the other.
And if number stays pretty.
The chromosome number is 6 to 8. We have a sort of phylogeny of that because we have been studying the centromere of these chromosomes. Centromeres are conserved, so we can tell which one is which based on the centromere. Then the arms are reshuffled. Yeah. Okay.
Can you define inversions and translocations along the axis
The question is, you don't see here what you usually see for bacteria. For example, you have a long diagonal like this and the opposite diagonal, which is the inversion. We don't see that here at this level. We see that when we look at genes, among the 100 or so genes, you see a pair which is like this. Okay, at this scale, they will not be visible. So we have small inversion in the synthetic block, and in fact there was a paper together with Massimo 2 years ago in which we were recalculating the frequency of internal inversion within the synthetic block. And so there are some, but they are always of small size. We don't have big chunk of inversion. Okay. We have gene deletion within synthetic block. We have a synthetic block with gene missing on one chromosome, as well as we have a gene insertion, because when we have a synthetic block, which is true for all 5 species, you will see in one of the species, you will see 1 or 2 genes in addition, because it is not in the other, the likely probability that it is an insertion rather than deletion in all of those.
Spontaneous inversion and translocation rates, like in
CBCA? Yeah, we've done that with Massimo. It was not this set of species did not exist at the time. So we are comparing this one, I think this one, probably this one, and that was it. And so there were some estimation, and according to that, the rates were not exactly equal from one branch to the next. Okay, this is as if the length of the branch, if they were equivalent to the rate, length of the branch would not be identical. Okay, so yeah.
On the other slide there, with the block time. Is there any distinction between a line going down and a line going up?
No, it's just arbitrary. The chromosomes are put left to right in the way they are assembled in the sequencing, because we don't know whether they are like this or like this. So if I turn this around, it would be just the opposite. Okay, there is no way to orient chromosomes. In fact, what is very misleading in literature, the chromosomes of Saccharomyces cerevisiae were discovered historically. So they have names A, B, C, D, and so forth, which are completely irrelevant of their size or whatever. The way it was done by geneticists, they discovered the one chromosome because there was one genetic marker linked to a centromere. Okay, and as soon as they discovered that, they put a new chromosome. If you look at the history, the chromosome number of cerevisiae has been reaching 16, 17, 18. There was paper asking whether there be an additional one. Okay, and then they have gone down to 16 after the sequencing. The way the geneticists did, they decided in 1950, the first marker they will find next to the centromere will be the right arm of the chromosome. Okay. So, as a result, they are like this, in every order, every possible order. For the new gene, for the new sequences, we have decided to number them according to size. Okay, so the smaller one, and but we have no way to tell which one is right, which one is left. Therefore, it's all arbitrary.
Okay. So in yeast, there are no strand biases that are introduced by
No, absolutely not. This is a good question. And I've studied that in Serbia quite extensively, and also now in the other East. If you look, there are minor strand bias in terms of which one is coding, which one is not coding. So if you go across the chromosome, you will see a couple of 2, 3, 5 genes in one strand, and then on the other strand, and on the other strand, and so forth. So, but it equilibrates over the whole chromosomes. But if you look locally, there are strand biases in the local scale, few genes. There is no strand bias over the complete chromosome. Okay.
The fact that you get roughly straight lines on this plot, right?
You call that straight lines here? Oh, I don't know. Yeah, here. Yes.
That says it's sort of the block size distribution.
Okay. This is the next slide. The same student has recalculated the size of blocks. This is now for all blocks, for all pairs. Okay. And this is the number of blocks. As you can see, we have a small number of blocks, usually one between 60 genes and 200, 300 genes. And we have larger and larger number of blocks when the blocks get smaller. And he has tried to feed that to exponential law. This is what he has found, which is clearly not fitting. He has fitted that to a power law distribution, which is the blue curve, which is here, which fits reasonably well, but not perfect. And then he has drawn the lowest curve, which of course fits very well because of the strategy it is made. So the curve, the lowest curve is that one here. So you see the distribution here. It was published the same thing by Pierre Bock for Drosophila 2 years ago, I think. And the distribution have the same shape, but the abscissae and ordinate are not exactly the same number. Okay, but the same shape distribution is here, so it's between a power law and something different. Yeah. So I don't know if it tells you something very much. If you read papers of Pierre Bock, he concludes that this excludes random breakage of chromosome. I think it's a very rapid conclusion. Maybe true, but maybe more complicated than that.
But precisely what you get when you randomly break the chromosome.
If you randomly break the chromosome, you end up with exponential law, yeah?
No exponential law, but you get power laws, I think.
If you randomly break the chromosome?
Yeah, because you get log normal.
I don't know. This is a figure that the student gets for this power law. The numbers here are different from the one in Drosophila case. Okay, so I don't know. Okay. So, but we can discuss. The next thing that the student has done was to compare the frequency of genes remaining in orthology, the different pairwise comparison, and the amino acid replacement in the homologous proteins. And what you see here is the following. A number of points are here. There should be a point 100 to 100 somewhere here, okay? But we don't have 100% amino acid conservation. There is a group of pairs here. There's a group of pairs here, and there's a group of pairs here. And if we want to draw lines in this group, it is as if down to about 80 or 85% synteny, we have, this is all protoploid. This is all protoploid yeast, 5 yeast. So they have up about from 100 to 95 to 85 synteny. And their amino acid replacement or amino acid identity goes from 65 to about 55%. Okay, so there's a very deep curve here in which amino acids are replaced. But the synteny is robust. Synteny is not change extensively. Then if you go much further, you have this group of yeast here, which include the Debaryomyces onceni, or this group of yeast which include Yarrowvia lipolytica even further. And you see that all five of them compared to this one are more or less identical, same here. And they are very low synteny. They have lower amino acid identity, as you might expect. But the curve here has a different it's a different curve compared to this one here. So as a result of that, we conclude that starting from the original ancestor up here, you have a first phase in which sequence diverge, protein sequence diverge, but synteny is relatively intact. Okay, it is not lost rapidly. And then there is a second phase, which is probably much longer in terms of time, in which the amino acid replacement is probably slowed down actually by the functional pressure on this thing. So you cannot replace anything by anything else. And synteny now slowly decreases down to nearly zero. With Yarrowvia lipolytica, as you have said, you see there is no synteny at all left between these yeast. So this is what we have for figures for the yeast. What is Yeah.
The thing there at the bottom is what fraction of the genes that are autologous are eucycosynthetic.
Yes,
right?
yes.
But that is there is something going in there that has to do with you being able to detect it.
Yes.
Right? Because when block size gets to a handful or something, then
yes.
You won't see it anymore. So
yes.
That might introduce quite some non-linearity in this.
I agree. This is a proportion of genes which are within the defined synthetic block. Basically, okay, and then it goes down to zero. Synthetic block are defined as a minimum of at least three consecutive members. Otherwise, you don't see them. Otherwise, we call them zero. Yeah.
I also want to say that this kind of observation has been made again and again and again.
Yeah.
In the literature.
Yeah.
I don't know of any instance in which people
convincingly
show that it wasn't just an artifact.
Yeah. This is again Pierre Bork for the Dendrophila 2 years ago. Exactly the same drawing, okay, and exactly the same result. Those are the Dendrophila. All they have 12 Dendrophila. So this is equivalent to our protoploid yeast. 12 Dendrophila are here. The 100% is somewhere here, and they have added other insects. Right here, and you see exactly the same shape. The figures are not the same. The amino acid identity are higher for the Drosophila compared to what we have for our yeast. Okay.
But in general, correction for multiple hits tends to underestimate.
Yeah. So this is. But the same curve is in this particular case. This also have also added fish and human and chicken and human, which is more or less fitting the same insect curve. Okay, the yeast curve are not so different, except that they will be a little bit below. That's as of today. Okay, so my result, my conclusion here is that synteny is strong enough for a certain period. So we have large pieces of chromosome conserved. They exchange pieces. So one chromosome will have pieces in almost every other chromosome with some time, but it is conserved for long enough period of time so that the amino acid can be replaced, the proteins can evolve, but the gene order is reasonably stable. And when you go beyond that, gene order completely disappears.
So I have a little, why can't you just have that the size of the synteny blocks just goes down linearly with time?
Yes.
They just shrink in a regular way with time.
Yeah.
At some phase rate.
Yeah.
And your ability to recognize these blocks will have almost a phase transition that at some point all of a sudden you won't see them anymore. And so if you plot this thing in orthodox, it looks like all of a sudden you take this jump that the synteny disappears. But it's not that this nothing nothing in evolution that really changes rates. It's
no, no,
the
it
ability
is.
Ability to see them.
I don't think it changed rate. I think the problem is we don't have the intermediate here because they simply do not exist. So we don't have things to compare that would be in this big gap between these two east of the out group and the other group here. So and therefore, the distance here may be this is not time. Okay, this is absolutely not time. It is quite possible that if you would put time, you will have a straight line here. Which is, but we don't have the data. They have slightly more data for the insects. If you look carefully, they have slightly, well, there's one here, okay? And then they have this group here. So again, they have this group here, there's one here, and there's one group here. So, and if the intermediate do not exist, well.
But maybe the case of those lots, as you're saying, maybe a better measure of time of divergence.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of protein divergence, especially when you get out to these.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You lose the ability.
I think that you're talking about, though, wouldn't you just see it in the number of odd lots? You're just comparing pairs, and you should see a break
in just the number of odd lots, at least.
No, because it has nothing to do with orthologs. Orthologs has to do with the things that are still each other's best match on amino acid.
Well, I thought that the argument was that with the divergence, you lose the ability to recognize orthologs.
No, you lose the ability. As the sintering blocks get smaller and smaller, it comes all of a sudden a point where you can't see the blocks anymore.
It is difficult to define a sintering block when you have a number of gene loss and insertion in between, or and or small inversion. So there is a point. There is a limit of in the definition. For the small one, there is a limit for the definition. Yeah. Okay. So.
I might argue that there might be a reason why the region in the middle is empty, which is that when you have whole genome duplication, when you have huge stress and there are a few species that emerge.
No. This has nothing to do with genome duplication. This is the yeast which are here. This is these five yeast here, which are compared either between themselves or with these two. We have ignored these two because this is a disaster. If you include these two, then the synteny blocks shrink to very small pieces. So we have ignored these two. We have taken these five yeasts from the same phylogenetic group as these two, but not duplicated, compare them to one another, or compare them to two outside group. Okay, this is what we've done.
Well, is it really that the synteny blocks will shrink to nothing? I mean, it's just that you have this one, two, three.
Okay, well, let me show you the figure here for Debiomyces on Seni was not nothing. It was 9 genes on average. The figure for Yarovia not shown here would be about 2-3 genes on average. Okay, so it's not nothing. It is.
Isn't it just the definition of something that you have this one two maps, so obviously the order is not.
The percent of genes included in synteny block here is shown here. So 90% of genes are included in synteny block for these. The percent of genes included in visible synteny block here is about 20%, and it will go down. Because then you have a number of genes which are unique. They are just by themselves, and you cannot tell which synteny block they belong. Yeah? They are just distributed all over the map. Yeah. There are more and more genes which look single on the map.
The 1-to-2 relation map calls for 80 or 90% of
tellable
genes, you know,
genome. The what? No. You cannot do that because if I would drop. Okay, here I have 90% of the genes included in this comparison. There are 10% additional gene not shown here. They would have single points everywhere in the drawing. Yeah. So because there's 10% of genes already in this comparison, which could not be attributed to any single synthetic group. This is only the synthetic group, but there is a background here which has been eliminated, which is a single gene. and they will fall everywhere. If I will draw that, you will see the whole space is covered by this single gene. Yeah. Okay. So that's where we are as of today for the synteny. Synteny is very useful because we can recalculate chromosome breakage, whatever, small gene inversions, small gene deletions, additions, and the like. We can make sure that the genes which are included in large blocks are the true orthologs because it's very unlikely that they have been exchanged and stay in the same place and things like that. But this is what we have for the synteny block as of today. Okay, next thing I would like to discuss now is basically how genes arise, and I will have three. So yesterday we have seen discussed a number of things on whole genome segmental duplication and the like. I'm not going back on that. I would like to discuss something on tandem gene arrays and expansion on short monotonous sequence repeats, things for which we observe that, but we don't understand much. I would like to discuss the transfer of sequences from organellar DNA, as well as horizontal gene transfer. We sort of understand a little bit better, but not completely what's going on there. And then I will finally discuss what we know as RNA-mediated events, formation of genes, not directly from other genes, but from retrocopies of RNAs. So, let me start with the tandem gene array. This is an old story which has been in literature for the last 40 years or so. Gene clusters were known, particularly in vertebrates. This is the alcohol dehydrogenase gene cluster, one of the most important gene clusters, at least for human. This is the human chromosome 4. This is the chicken. It was published a few years ago. You see that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 genes in that cluster, which are all alcohol dehydrogenase, probably because we drink too much, or I don't know. There's a pseudo gene, as often found in these clusters. You have a cluster of other things. And what is shown here, that the cluster is conserved between man and chicken, but again, man and chicken are not very far apart. So the cluster is conserved. The chicken has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 genes, one pseudogene. The equivalence of MAP could be drawn with some exception. For example, that gene here, based on sequence identity, that gene here has been expanded in 4 genes in human. And these 3 genes in chicken are not present in the human copy. So this was described in literature for many years. There is nothing new with that. In case of vertebrates, the distance is large enough. So the genes are in the order, but they are usually separated by relatively long intergenic distances. So. Okay. The yeast, before we go to yeast, the number of tandem genes, this is called tandem gene arrays in the modern literature. The number of tandem gene arrays have been computed for human, mouse, and rat by these people here. They found about 900 of them or 800 of them in total in the human, mouse, and rat genome, assuming either 2 genes of the same family next to each other or 2 genes of the same family separated by 1 spacer gene. And assuming you can tolerate 1 spacer, 2 or 3, and 4, etc., the number of arrays, of course, will slightly increase. Okay. So about 13 to 17% of the total genes of this species are in fact made of tandem gene arrays. If we look at the size of tandem gene arrays, they follow a polar law distribution, except for the very large arrays, and arrays more than 10 genes, which are clearly more frequent than they would expect from this low distribution. Okay. Now we've done exactly the same thing with yeast, assuming 2 genes next to each other or separated by 1, 2, 3 or more additional genes. And what you see immediately that it looks like the vertebrates, the curves increase as you, this is just natural. But the number of tandem genares is much smaller. It represents roughly 1-3% of the total gene compared to the 14-15% for vertebrates, except for one yeast, which we just observed like this. The Bryomyces oncinii, that particular yeast, has many more tandem genares, including large one, compared to the other yeast. And we have absolutely no, well, we did not expect that. We just observed that. More, the other yeast are nearly identical, not exactly, but they are nearly identical. This one is clearly different from all others by the number of tandem genares. So there is a number of surprise that we don't yet understand. I would like to illustrate one point of tandem genare, which is now in Candida glabrata. Candida glabrata is not different from the other yeast in terms of numbers. Okay, it is a human pathogen, and there are three interesting cases of large expansion of tandem genare. Here is one. In Cerevisiae, that gene codes for alpha-1-3-mannosyl transferase, which is one enzyme important for the cell wall synthesis of the yeast. Okay. And in Candida glabrata, as you can see, on a synthetic block with Cerevisiae, we have an expansion of up to 9 copies of the same kind of gene. The tRNA is still there. And then there's the chromosome breakage. The other gene next to it in Candida are now on different chromosomes in Saccharomyces cerevisiae. So there is a large expansion, 9 genes, large cluster of genes. The function of them are not completely identified. They are of the family of mannosyl transferase. But they may be doing a variety of function of this enzyme, and the reason to believe that is because if we look at the amino acid conservation between those proteins or the nucleotide conservation of the gene, you will see that it is extremely poor. So the tandem genares is not formed of identical copies. It is formed here of very diverged copies in terms of sequence. We have three other cases of expansion of that sort in Candida glabrata. One is an aspartic protease, one code for an aspartic protease, and the other one is of unknown function. Okay. So what has happened here is what makes sense is changing the cell wall of Candida glabrata by changing the number of these enzymes and maybe the activity of these enzymes. This may be important for the adaptation of the species as a human pathogen growing on epithelium, for example. That makes sense. You can same for the aspartic protease. The aspartic protease are secreted enzymes that will secrete proteases, which may be important for the inflammatory process developed by Candida glabrata. How this is formed is a mystery, because we know in Saccharomyces cerevisiae two cases in which a single gene can be expanded. One is giving the resistance to the copper. But in this particular case, this is identical copies, which are repeated several times, up to 15 times in cerevisiae for the copper resistance. In this case, one possibility could be that they were identical copies when they were formed, and they have diverged extremely rapidly because there was some kind of selective pressure to have a diversity of function. Okay, this is one possibility. We don't know that. But you look at the numbers here. These two are 80% identical, which is not bad, but this is the best we have. Then you go down to 60, 50, even less than one of them is 40% identical. And we have figures like that in several cases in this list. Okay, so there are big expansion of tandem arrays for reasons we think we can understand, but we don't understand the mechanism yet by which these tandemaries are formed. In addition to that, there is a strange observation here. If we look at the population of Candida glabrata, the different strains do not have nine copies, each one of them. Some of them have seven, some of them have nine, some of them have eight, and so forth. So it varies a little bit. It varies mostly because there are two short pieces here, which are intergenic pieces. They are identical, 100% identical in sequence. This is the only case like this. And you have looping out between those two sequences. So it's a very quick variation in number. So we have strains with six genes, strains with nine genes, and so forth. There are other variations that we don't understand because the number of these genes disappear in one strain or the other, and we don't know. So there's some intraspecific polymorphism, despite the fact that the sequences are no longer identical. What I mean, this is the sequence in terms of amino acid, which means in terms of DNA, the sequences are simply different. They are less than 50% identical in DNA.
They're identical to each other.
Yes.
It's not that they're identical between
these things. Identical to each other in Glabrata, they do not exist in Cerevisiae or in the other yeast. Okay. And they are a strong hotspot for polymorphism, as you might expect. Yeah. So there.
It seems pretty obvious that you didn't mention is that this expansion occurred pretty much instantaneously. You know, with a couple of exceptions, like 81%, but all the others are 50, 60, 62.
Yeah.
I'm suggesting that there was a single expansion and everything's been diverging since that time. Not a kind of stepwise
variable. That's the possibility. There are some numbers here. Yeah, we have tried to reconstruct that. The trouble is they were diverged enough so that if you look for DNDS substitution or things like that, it is already saturated. So that is not the best. So we cannot really tell. Okay,
we cannot really. I mean, they don't have very good resolution, but.
Yeah.
First approximation.
Yeah. Yes. It looks at it. Look, yeah. We will have hard time to reconstruct the what has really happened in this particular case. Yeah.
Do you think that there's a chromosomal break?
There's a chromosomal break next to a tRNA gene, which is also something which is correlated. tRNA genes are often found at the border of a synthetic block, either because they are themselves the trigger of the exchange, possibly because of this distribution of identical sequences of tRNA gene. But tRNA genes are very small, 70, 80 nucleotides, so you cannot really tell that they will trigger homologous recombination. They will not do that. Okay. They will act as dispersed repetitive sequences, but they are short dispersed repetitive sequences. So there is something there, but it is a fact that it's very often you find a tRNA gene next to a break. Okay, and it may be that this expansion has something to do with the fact that it's next to a break. No. Okay, that's another example we have. Now, I'd like to, in the same idea, I'd like to tell you of something else. In yeast, Cerevisiae, as well as in all other yeast, we have proteins with low complexity sequences. Here is one example here, made of serine, repeated several times. Here is a huge example of serine and so forth. Serine threonine repeats are very frequent in Saccharomyces cerevisiae. They are not so frequent in other yeast. I will show you some examples of that. So here is another interesting example. This is, of course, it creates this diagram when you do a self-matrix because of the repeats. The repeats are extremely unstable. That means if we take different isolates of Cerevisiae, the number of repeats changes, and sometimes they completely disappear. Some strains do not have the repeats. Okay. Yeah, but here's a paper we have published 2 years ago, in which we have recalculated the repeats in protein coding genes, mini satellite in protein coding genes, in all Escherichia proteins, and you will see that the motif goes from 4 amino acids, 12 nucleotides, up to 64 amino acids, 192 nucleotides. In Escherichia, as I have said, many of these repeats are serine threonine rich, some of them up to 100%. Some of them are low in serine threonine, but this is the type of repeat we have. They are distributed in different kinds of proteins. In particular, the proteins involved in cell wall synthesis, the protein involved in external adhesion and so forth, as shown in this slide. Cell wall biogenesis, this list of proteins has the repeat I just mentioned. But there are few in cell division and budding, some in transcription RNA processes, other functions, and the like. If you look at the conservation of the proteins and genes of Escherichia to the other yeast, including S. paradoxus, which is the closest relative, then Glabrata, Lactis, and the like, you will see that the conservation is very weak. Even S. paradoxus, which is it's almost 100% synthetic with Escherichia, this one, only 65% of the repeats found in Escherichia are also present in Paradoxus. And when you go to Candida glabrata, only a quarter, and then it goes like this. Okay. So they are there. For reasons we think we understand, they are in the protein involved in cell wall. For other reasons we don't really understand, they are in transcription factor and so forth. Okay. And they are variable. These two people from my lab have now studied an additional phenomenon of that, discovered in Candida glabrata again, the pathogenic yeast, which is the following. Here again is this drawing. These are proteins involved in adhesion to the epithelium, and they have many of these repeats. What you can see here is the strain, type strain sequence. This is another strain from Candida glabrata, and you see that they diverge in size. The repeat here is slightly smaller here, this one is slightly larger, and so forth. As I have said, from strain to strain, they diverge. The repeats are the point where the very quick divergence. For this gene here, you have one repeat here which is found here smaller. This one here is almost not visible, but this is this big one here. And this one here is this tiny one here, okay, and so forth. In two strains, which are, by other means, are nearly 100% sequence identity. They are 0.1% 0.1% SNP, sequence divergence. Okay. So they have discovered that in Candida glabrata, this is a map of Candida glabrata, and they have discovered that there are genes with such repeats basically all over the genomes, with some preference sometimes for the subtelomeric region, but there are many everywhere. Yeah. Here is one example. Here is a 135 nucleotide long repeat unit, 45 amino acids, which is repeated in that particular gene, repeated 16 times. Identical or nearly identical in 16 times in the sequence strain and another number of times in the other strain. Here is another example, more complicated. 90 amino acids, 270 nucleotides, repeated 3 times, identical, followed by another repeat, 45 amino acids, repeated 6 times, followed by a complex repeat, 156 nucleotides, so I think it's 52 amino acids, plus a repeat of 12 nucleotides, 4 amino acids. So there is this, plus this type of 4, 7 times here, again this one, 4 times here, again this one, 4 times, and so forth. So there is a complex kind of structure in this particular protein here. Here is, whoops, Here is what they have compiled out of that. In a large number of genes, more than 20 genes or so of Candida glabrata, these genes contain repeats of this type of family, which is called SHITT, because it has, in jargon we call it the shit repeat. it has a serine, histidine, okay, and you see the light. It's made of about 40 amino acids. This is a different subfamily. You will see that some of them differ by one deletion here, and a small deletion here. They have a central region, which is quite variable. And you will see that in other motifs of the same or other gene, that central region itself is expanded by a serine, in this particular case, serine glycine-rich repeats, and, or in this particular case, a very long motif shown here, which makes repeats of 100 amino acids, 300 nucleotide longs. And there are 10, 15 cases of such thing. In fact, just for a matter of history, when I started to sequence Candida glabrata, it was 6 years ago. There are so many of them that the first thing I found out of the sequence were long open reading frames of 300 nucleotides, and they were repeated many times. I could not find anything else. So I was sequencing a novel yeast and discovered that this novel yeast genome was made of repeats of 100 nucleotides. And in fact, this number of repeats are so numerous that they cover several percent of the genome of Cerevisiae, and we just find them first. Okay, why is that? We don't know. It will create novel properties for quite a number of proteins. It's extremely variable from one strain to the next. Okay, how it is made, we don't know either. What we suspect is out of a normal gene, a small mini satellite is formed and then randomly repeated. And what we have observed in those many cases, that in a structure like this, a new additional motif gets inserted by one mechanism or another. We have no idea. These motifs do not look like anything else in the database. They're just specific for glabrata. And some motif is inserted, and then it is itself duplicated in tandem, forming the final structure that we have. When we look at the sequences of these motifs, they are close enough, therefore they are not saturated in terms of the neutral versus non-neutral substitution. So we can reconstruct an order of the apparition of this different motif. Again, the point is the sequence of this motif has been created de novo, apparently, because they don't look like anything else in database. And there is simply no match to anything. They are in Candida glabrata many times, but nowhere else. That's one thing. And they are randomly repeated quite often inside other repeats themselves. Okay. So that's again a fact. We don't have a real mechanism for that. Nice again, because this is my bias, a nice point would be that this is a part of the retro element which has been inserted once and then has proliferated. But it's pure speculation. I have no idea how it works. Absolutely zero. It's specific for this Candida glabrata, extremely polymorphic in terms of numbers between the strains. And okay.
Somebody tried to take one of these motifs and do NMR or something like that, don't they?
No, I have discussed that with a number of structural people, and I was always disappointed because I said, well, this is interesting. If you're in protein chemistry, you might be interested to have a protein with, it's 100 amino acids repeated up to 16 or 20 times. Okay, so it's a big piece. And you might be interested in that. And I said, well, we usually, when we have genes like that, we usually cut the motif because they make trouble in our structure analysis. This is the type of see, we are interested. I agree. It would be nice to have the structure of this particular type of motif. If they have a structure, which may not, because this, they usually complain because the small motifs do not have the structure and they screw up their experiment. So, yeah. So that's it. Another thing would be also nice, because it's something we could do easily in our lab, would be we could reconstruct the gene without those motifs, and we could make mutant of that sort and look for the phenotype of these mutants and see whether there is something which is specific to the existence of this motif or not, which is not done. Okay.
Do you know that these motifs are functional? Can you splice them out and?
No, this is what I said. We should do that. This is what I said. We should do that. We should replace those genes by a normal gene without the motif and look for the.
Maybe just chance motifs.
There are so many of them. They are not. We don't have such thing in all yeast. This is something which is in this particular yeast.
But it might be some insertion mechanism which recognizes the splice site and puts them there anyways.
It could be. It could be. We have a few species not yet finally sequenced, but some of them are partially sequenced. We have a few species related to Candida glabrata, but they are not extremely close. That's unfortunately, we don't have that. Some of them have part of the motif. So it is as if the whole clade or whatever has this property of forming that. Okay. What else? Maybe I should finish that and then we have a break. Interorganella gene transfer. Also something, well, it was described 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that pieces of chloroplast DNA can be found in mitochondria of maize. Okay. It was described a year later that pieces of chloroplast DNA can be found in the nucleus of spinach. And it was described the same year that pieces of mitochondrial DNA can be found in the nucleus of the sea urchin and the yeast. Okay, that was 25 years ago or so. Now things have changed, and we find such pieces are now called NUMT, nuclear mitochondrial transfer, and such pieces are called NUPT, nuclear plastic transfer. Okay. Now we know. Well, there are NUMPs and NUPs in many genomes, not all, but in many genomes, over 80 eukaryotic species, of course. NUMPs are found in plants, if you need to have chloroplast. We know that there are two cases, two types of NUMPs. Some of them are made of short pieces of mitochondrial DNA, usually less than 100 or a few hundred nucleotides long, and some of them are made of long pieces of mitochondrial DNA, even the complete molecule. In Arabidopsis thaliana, for example, there are several copies of mitochondrial DNA in the nucleus. I think the cat has almost half of the mitochondrial DNA in its nucleus and other things like that. But generally, they are small pieces, about 100 nucleotides, 120, 200, this size, okay? What we have done ourselves was to demonstrate already a few years ago, to demonstrate that in yeast, pieces of mitochondrial DNA can be found after repair of double-strand break of chromosomes. And in fact, this is published almost 10 years ago. We were engineering the chromosomes with an artificial nuclease forming double-strand break and forming a gap, eliminating a marker. And we were looking for the repair of this break. And to our surprise, we discovered at the time that quite a number of these repairs were done by inserting pieces of mitochondrial DNA into the broken part. And another paper by another group was published about the same time using a slightly different technology, and they ended up with the same conclusion that broken chromosomes are the site where pieces of mitochondrial DNA, short pieces originating from anywhere, short pieces get inserted. Okay. These two persons here recently have re-examined the mitochondrial DNA NUMT pieces in the yeast, and what you can see immediately that this one has only one, almost nothing, this one very few, this one has a lot, and those are intermediate number. And the total number of mitochondrial DNA pieces, total number of NUMT found in yeast varies by two logs in this particular case. I would like to draw your attention to the mosaics. What we call mosaics is the following. Quite frequently, here in 23 cases out of that, here in 4 cases out of that, and in our experiment it was also observed, quite frequently, the insert of mitochondrial DNA is multiple. So here in this is a big case in the biomyces. You see a piece of 83 nucleotide from this position of mitochondrial DNA, followed by 121 from this position, followed by 68 from this one, and so on. So all together, the NUMT is made of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different pieces of mitochondrial DNA from different places of the genome and oriented in one orientation or the other compared to the mitochondrial map. These structures are relatively frequent. Here we have 23 of them for the, and this is the number of pieces. So the 23 of them makes about half of this number of species. Okay. So this is we have found them in double strand break repair. So when we have double strand break repair, we find sometimes mosaics of several pieces of mitochondrial DNA inserted simultaneously with this double strand break repair. So at this stage, I hypothesize that notice that the fragments are short. The fragments ignore genes. We have half tRNA molecule, we have a piece of gene there, a piece of an intron, we have everything we can think of in this. Fragmentation of mitochondrial DNA occur probably as a catastrophic or massive event, maybe of the apoptotic type. During the apoptosis, mitochondrial DNA gets fragmented in one type, in fragment about this size. So maybe this is what happens. These yeast do not do apoptosis. Then it is transferred to the nucleus by a yet unknown mechanism, but it is probably of the same nature as DNA transformation. The DNA goes to the nucleus when you put a plasmid, so why not? And it is integrated by double strand break repair because we have demonstrated that. Okay, so this is the
Yes.
Yes, I know.
So you don't know the
mechanism. We don't know that. We don't have that. The cells do not die, otherwise we do not find that. And the yeast do not go to the complete cycle of apoptosis. But the yeast may have the fragmentation of mitochondrial DNA as part of that. That's one thing. This is found in haploid. Do we have cases in diploid? No, I don't think so. The experiment is done in haploid. It has been done in Cerevisiae. Similar experiment have been done in Saccharomyces pombe, which is another non-related yeast, and with the same result. Okay. So.
So why were the chromosomes broken in the first place? And if they were broken, wouldn't that be a dead cell?
No, because, well, there are between 20 and 50 or 80 mitochondrial DNA molecules per cell. So you can break one in pieces without any phenotype.
Step three there is the nuclear chromosome.
Oh, the nuclear chromosome, if you look at that, when we have done the experiment here, the survival is 1%, 99%, if they don't repair the break. They stop. If they don't repair, they stop. Okay. The one that repair will find mitochondrial DNA. If you have a double strand break in a chromosome and you have no way to repair in the haploid, then you will stop the cell cycle and eventually die.
How okay. Can you just see ligation?
This was about half of the case, the ligation, non-homologous and zoning without mitochondrial DNA, about half of the case. This was the other half. Okay.
But Is there anything in yeast like these restriction modification systems that you have to make it
No, it doesn't exist. It does not exist in eukaryote.
And can you estimate the sort of age distribution of these knobs?
Yes, sort of, except for one thing. They are quite small. So when you have 10% sequence divergence of something which is quite small, or 20% sequence divergence, they tend to disappear. You simply do not detect them. The numbers here are the limit of detection. Maybe there are many more, but we don't see them. If you have 10% sequence divergence of 83 nucleotides, that's 8 nucleotides. If you want to compare these 8 to, say, 20% of these 7, which will be 14, it's difficult to tell the age. It's very difficult to tell the age. Okay. But they are not conserved when we compare the different yeast, including Cerevisiae versus Paradoxus. They are simply not conserved. Yeah. So they are different. Now the question about the consequences of these NUMPs. Of course, you may say that there is no consequence; they are neutral. And in fact, most are found in intergenic regions, both in yeast and human, and or in long impound in human. So most of them are simply probably neutral. They could be mutagenic because they could inactivate a gene, a chromosomal gene. I will show you an example later. Or they could be creative because they could be the source of novel possible exons. There are a few cases, not many, but they are clear-cut in plants. Here is one case in yeast in which we have compared. This is a nuclear DNA. This is the Debiomyces onceni, which has received the NUMP here. And this is a related species, Picia stipitis, which do not have the NUMP here. And you can see here that the NUMP insertion in this particular case has extended the reading frame, has extended the protein. So there is some possibility to change genes and create normal protein due to the constant influx of mitochondrial DNA. There is another one in which, again in yeast, in which this is a gene with 5 introns in yeast. Well, there's only 2 genes like this, so, okay. This is a beta glucosylated cause. And in this particular case, the NUMP has jumped inside the intron. And it could be that the NUMP becomes part of the exon by mutation of the intron. That's a possibility we don't know. I would like to finish by one example in the human genome, and then we'll stop. We have NUMPs. We have identified ourselves 211 NUMPs in 2004. Another group, 3 years later, has identified about twice as many NUMPs in our genome. We have compared NUMPs of human and chimpanzee in both cases. And about 86% of them are common between NUMPs and chimpanzees, but again, we are very, very close species, and about 15% are specific for one lineage or the other. One interesting example here is an accident, a young boy, which was published a few years ago. There are several cases of genetic disease in human, which are due to NUMP insertion. But this is an interesting one. This young boy has anomalous development because there was a 72 base pair fragment of mitochondrial DNA inserted in exon 14 of that gene. And that gene, that insertion has created a dominant negative phenotype in one of the developmental genes for gene dosage effect. And it was followed by SNP, it was followed, what is the origin of the insertion? And the origin of the insertion has occurred in the meiosis of the father. Neither parents have the NUMP. But the child has a NUMP, and in fact, based on SNP distribution, it was shown that the NUMP has arisen in the gametes of the father. And it just turned out that this gametogenesis was coincidence with Chernobyl, because it was in the Chernobyl area. You can speculate that it was double strand break and so forth. Based on one case, I would not go too far on that, but this is a spectacular case. So here is one clear-cut negative gene inactivation result. There's few other cases. There's some hemophilic cases due to NUMT insertion. So we can create novel sequences based on NUMT from time to time, and of course we can create novel mutation based on NUMT. And just to finish my story, here is another topic, which is not no longer mitochondrial DNA, but which is horizontal gene transfer. And the best example, there are very few in East, very, very few. The best example we have so far is probably this one. This is an enzyme, well, in the history, Saccharomyces cerevisiae was known to have the URAS1 gene, which is a gene involved for uracil biosynthesis, which is dehydroorotate dehydrogenase. And it was known for years, for thousands of years, that yeast can live in the complete anaerobiosis. That enzyme can work in the absence of oxygen. In eukaryotes, the dehydroorotate dehydrogenase needs oxygen to work, not in bacteria, okay, and not in cerevisiae. And this is a work by this group here published a few years ago, in which they have shown that if you look at these yeast and this fungi, they have the eukaryotic type of enzyme, which needs oxygen all the way here, and then this enzyme has disappeared. This is a mitochondrial enzyme called URAN9, which is a dehydroorotate dehydrogenase. And if you look at these yeast, they have the bacterial type of enzyme, called URA1, which is a cytosolic enzyme, which do not need oxygen. And if you look at this tree, you see that these yeast have both. None of them have the bacterial type. All of them, except these two, have the bacterial type. Some of them have both. And some of them have lost either this one, or this one, or this one. And what you can see here is that there has been some secondary loss of the prokaryotic enzyme in these two lines. So they use only the eukaryotic type. In this Saccharomyces sensu stricto group, this one here, they have lost the eukaryotic type and they only have the bacterial type. And as a result, they are facultative anaerobe. So as a result of that, first of all, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the one yeast, is a genetically modified organism, but it was genetically modified some million years ago by transformation with some bacterial gene. And in fact, the reason we can make wine is because there was an accident of horizontal gene transfer somewhere here that has replaced the eukaryotic type of enzyme by the bacterial type of enzyme. Otherwise, we would not be able to make wine because simply the yeast would not grow in the anaerobiosis. So, I think it's an interesting example to recall. We do have a few other cases of horizontal gene transfer, not many. We have just rediscovered, the student I mentioned, Thomas Roland, has just rediscovered an enzyme which is completely specific to bacillus. It's all bacilli have this enzyme, nothing else. And in one of these yeast, which is, I think, this one here or something like that, that enzyme is present, and the gene is, as quite often, the gene is in several copies, two or three copies in the genome. The horizontal gene transfer happens. The example we have, there are less than a dozen which have been described. The examples we have are usually metabolic enzyme, as you might expect, because when they are transferred, they work on the same substrate and same product. There may be other things, but I will, other kinds of transfer, but this is just to illustrate the transfer that we have for functional genes from outgroup. So I think I will stop here and for a few minutes and finish with the RNA if you are interested. Yeah. Okay. So the final part I would like to try to discuss with you is basically the non-coding RNA molecules, and can we make genes out of RNA molecules and in different systems? This is something. And I would like to start with a beautiful example in which, as you know, we have millions of ALU sequences. If I'm correct, 1.1 million of different types in our genomes. ALU sequences are shown that exist, and they are non-coding RNA molecule. And what I would like to just illustrate is one example in which ALU sequences, there are many in literature, but one example in which ALU sequences can jump, of course they are mobile, they can, in the genome, they can jump into gene and they can form novel coding sequence. And the best example I have found is by my friend Jürgen Brosius lab. He has published that 3 years ago. This is the gene RP21, epimerase, and he has discovered in human that in intron 2, there is an ALUJ sequence, which is they are always antisense compared to the gene, always. Okay, and in fact, that ALUJ sequence is exonized, because the mutation here has occurred, making that an intron, and therefore after splicing, the ALU sequence will be included in the coding coding message in the messenger RNA molecule. And things like that have been described in other cases. What is nice about this work is they have studied all of these primates, and we are supposed to be here. Yeah? He has shown that the ALUJ insertion itself was introduced at this point of the phylogeny. And after something like 20 million years or so, the mutation at the junction has made the exonification, because if an ALU sequence jump into an intron, nobody cares, because the intron will be splice anyway. You don't see that here. And after 20 million years, it was exonified. We find it in Yomo, in Pan, in Pongo. In this particular case, the mutation is reversed, such that ALU sequence is now again part of the intron. So I think it's an interesting example of the formation of a novel protein coding genes. This ALU sequence about 300 or so nucleotides, or about 100 amino acids. There are several examples in literature in which we see in human genome protein coding genes made of the assembly of one or a few ALU sequences, which are always in the opposite orientation compared to the gene itself. The opposite orientation of the ALU sequence as an open reading frame, basically. So because there are many ALU sequences, you can combine with many different sequences. So this is an example. Okay. Now, the question is, do we find this in yeast? Of course not, for a number of reasons. First of all, yeast do not have ALU sequences, that's for sure. Second, to do that, you need retrotransposon. The ALU sequences are mobilized by the line elements in human, so you need that. Yeast have retrotransposon. Actually, retrotransposon were discovered in yeast, but there are not many, and I will illustrate that in a minute. Yeast have a limited number of introns, and of course, the more introns you have, the greatest probability you have to have an ALU sequence jumping in something which is tolerable, not a negative mutant. And something else which I've not discussed so far, yeast do not have any RNA I control compared to any other eukaryotes. All of the phylum of E. myascomycete have lost the RNA I control. They have lost all of the genes coding for the argonaut and so forth. What we have observed, which was not expected, is that a number of strange things has occurred in non-coding RNA molecule: expansion of domain, transcriptional fusion, and a specific expansion I will illustrate in a minute. possibly because of the absence of RNAi control, what we see is reflects what would not be tolerated by the RNAi control. Okay. Just to illustrate spliceosomal introns. It is in literature, it is found everywhere that yeast cerevisiae has very few introns. In fact, there is something like almost 270 and so forth. About 4% of the genes are split. The introns are considered usually, they are written as small. In fact, when we compare the other yeast, the number of introns is sometimes even smaller. And the introns are always also usually even smaller themselves. Okay. In addition to that, most yeast genes have a single intron. Very few of them have several. I was mentioning before one case with five, but this is really the spectacular example. Otherwise, we don't have that. So there are few introns in total. That one is slightly more, 11% of the gene compared to this 4, 5, 6% here, but still a minority of genes have introns. So the overall size of intron in this genome will be a few percent, whereas the overall size of intron in human genome will be at least 20% or something like that. Yeah. So few introns, that's number one. Second, yeast have retrotranspondons. In fact, the TY element were discovered, and the retroposition itself was discovered in Saccharomyces cerevisiae in 1984 or 43. And it was discovered the complete cycle of the TY1 element, similar to the retroviruses, is operating in Saccharomyces cerevisiae. It was also described subsequently that several families of TY elements exist in Saccharomyces cerevisiae. This one is homologous to Copia in Drosophila and other organisms. This one is a different type, homologous to the Gypsy in Drosophila and other organisms. Okay. It was described slightly later that in Candida albicans, they are retro elements of this type or the other. This was about 10 years ago. What we have today is that a huge series of retro elements of the Copia type or of the Gypsy type, and we also have DNA elements, non-retroposons, DNA normal type, bacterial type, I would say, transposable elements. Okay. If you look carefully, we can date that. We can date the apparition of these transposable elements along the phylogeny. I don't want to go into details of that because they have been reinserted several times. Okay, this is a DNA element which has been inserted in this group of yeast. This is the one here. It has been secondarily relost, and if you look at these elements, all of them are now dead. Okay, the TY5 element has been inserted at this point here, and if you look at this distribution of these elements, you find them rarely, and they are always dead. Okay, this one has appeared here. This one is a frequently found element. This one is specific to this group of Saccharomyces sensu stricto. You find it only in this yeast here. If you look at the active element, very few of them are active. Active means that they are complete sequences, and in case of cerevisiae, that they can transpose. They do transpose. For the others, we are pretty sure they are not active because the sequences are simply not complete. Therefore, they cannot be active because they are missing a lot of sequences. And if you look at the relics, non-active elements, they are all over. So the yeast have quite a number of retroposons. In most branches, different acquisition. In most branches, they tend to be gradually lost. Saccharomyces cerevisiae is an exceptional example with many active elements of the order of 30 to 50. Most yeast have one or two complete elements which could be active. Okay, usually they have very few complete elements. They have a lot of the traces. These elements loop out and leave behind what we call LTR, long terminal repeat, 300 base pair and piece. And there are many of them in all of the genome. Usually a couple of hundred are found. So the elements were there not long ago, but they are gone. Very few of them are still complete. Okay. Okay, that's what we have. One case of active element, CY element, forming genes in yeast has been published by this group a few years ago. And it is a beautiful example. So this shows that CY1 element can form active retrogene in yeast. This is now proven experimentally. Okay. How frequently it does that in nature is something else, but in the experiment, you can do that. These people, what they have done, they start from a gene called URA2, which is a triple, it's a fusion between several domains, and it's an important gene for the uracil biosynthesis. And the C-terminal part of the protein is the ATCase. These people have engineered the gene by putting a number of mutation, deletion, and so forth, so that it cannot revert. So this is a URA minus strain. And what they have been selecting is spontaneous URA plus strain. Okay, and when they have been analyzing the URA plus, ATCase plus, I should say, ATCase plus strain. Okay, when they have been analyzing that, they have discovered that none of these mutations revert. Of course, there are just too many of them. But in fact, the ATCase domain was reinserted elsewhere in an ectopic position in the genome, okay? And in most of the cases, it was inserted next to a TY or next to a piece of a TY element, okay? And if they have manipulated the TY element by putting a GAL promoter, which is a classical construction for yeast, GAL promoter is on galactose and off on glucose. And if they measure the frequency of the ATCase plus revertant, they find a 1,000 times increase when you turn on the promoter of this TY element. So the model is that the transcription of that gene, natural gene, gets encapsulated into one of the TY1 or TY2 particle, and after when the TY element retropose, there is a template switching of the reverse transcriptase, which normally would copy the TY element, which instead would copy the ATCase domain, and we reinsert the whole thing into the chromosome. So the complete cycle is done. You can do as many of these as you like. The ATCase always end up in a different region of the genome. Yeah?
I'm a bit confused. So there is a mutated copy of URA2 in the genome.
It's a mutated copy of URA2, but that
stop codons in it or something. Or?
Several stop codons here, one deletion, several mutations. This is a stop codons and deletion.
But wouldn't the mRNA then be targeted for thousands
of years? No, well, it should be, and it is possibly are, but not 100%. Okay, the way they do that, they select for the reappearance of the ATCase functional motif, which cannot be translated here because of the structure of the gene. So they select for that, and they find some frequency of the appearance so that you can go very low to 10 to the minus 6 or something like that. Okay, so.
It's more common than, for instance, making a new ribosomal star site in front of the ATCase in your original gene.
Yes, it has never occurred. It has never occurred, okay? This has simply never occurred. In eukaryote, it will be extremely difficult because the messenger RNA is supposed to be capped here and polyadenylated here, and there is no way for the ribosome to find this place. So it won't, in eukaryote, it won't work like that. In bacteria, you would start a new translation here, but eukaryote won't do that. So.
Encapsulate.
No, I think the I think that, well, this is, okay. The fact, the experiment is, this is the starting point. This is the mutant that you would recover. Okay, this is the experiment. If you turn on the TY element, you increase 1,000 times the frequency of mutant. This is the experiment. The model is that you translate this gene, and this molecule, which is not yet degraded by an MD or whatever, okay, this molecule will be encapsulated and will serve as a template for the reverse transcriptase of the TY element. Reverse transcriptase, we start with a 3-3 prime end anyway, so the structure is appropriate, okay, because it will start from that. Whether it goes to this point or not doesn't matter, basically. We will stop somewhere here, okay, and we will switch. Quite often, they are linked to a TYA gene, which is the upstream gene of the TY element. So there must be a switch between the ATCAs, somewhere in the ATCAs, and the TY element. Because they select for the function. Therefore, every switch which occurs somewhere in the ATCAs, you don't see that. They just select for the active one. Yeah? Okay. I think if I'm correct, to look at this paper, I think it's all the way to the minus 6 year, something like that. This is probably tensor of this order. And this is 1,000 times more frequent. If you, yeah.
So this is per?
This is per whatever. Checking that. I would suspect something of that order, something you can easily select. You just play 10 to the 6 cell, you get one revertant. This is what it is. Yeah?
Sorry, what is encapsulation?
The TY elements forms pseudo-viral particles in which the product of the TYA gene is a part of the capsid, of the viral capsid. They are not a complete viral capsid. They have only one part of that. And if you overexpress, it's difficult to find normally in yeast, but if you overexpress the TY element, you will see lots of particles in the cell. You see big bags of viral-like particles in the cell, which are made of the TYA protein product, plus one or two copies of the messenger RNA for the TY element itself, plus the enzyme retrotranscriptase, which is encapsulated as well. In the virus, then they are transported into another organism. Those are defective retroviruses, so they start their own replication within the same cell, okay? And the reverse transcriptase will copy the messenger RNA molecule of the TY element and reinsert that into the chromosome. That's a normal cell cycle of the TY element, okay? Okay, so in fact, retrogenes can be formed. That's clear. This is demonstrated in the lab. How often it is formed in nature is something else. Okay, we have looked at ourselves, but it was not very convincing because we don't have so many signals for what is a retrogene in yeast because for the lack of introns. Because for the other case, it's easy. You just look for lack of introns, but we don't have introns to start with. So. Okay. Another case which was observed completely independently is that non-coding other non-coding RNA molecules tend to expand in the yeast for reasons which we don't absolutely understand. Here is an RNA, it was described in Cerevisiae for several years that the non-coding RNA molecules for Cerevisiae are huge. For example, the spliceosome U1, U2, U4, 5, 6, the uRNA of spliceosome in Cerevisiae, they are big compared to anything else. It was not known why, but they are, okay. And in fact, they tend to expand with time according to phylogeny. There is an RNSP molecule published by this group. Here is the normal RNSP. The RNSP, if you don't know, is the enzyme which cleaves the precursor tRNA molecule. It's a universal enzyme in all kinds of eukaryotes. And these people discovered that compared to the normal RNSP in this Candida glabrata, There is a very huge insertion here, 488, 5 nucleotides at this particular position, a smaller insertion here, and a medium-sized insertion in this particular case. If you would draw this insertion, they would look as if they were a long hairpin structure, more or less complete double-stranded RNA, okay, in addition, okay. Another example is shown for the telomerase RNA, again from Candida glabrata. The telomerase RNA is usually, this is the core sequence of the telomerase RNA, the active enzyme, as in for RNase-P. And you will see that in addition to this core sequence, which is of course universal, there are insertion of pieces of sequences to make long RNA, this is the RNA itself, about 2.5 kilobase long instead of the normal 1 kilobase long or something like that. Okay. Another example was again found by again the same group of people for the now this is U1 spliceosomal RNA, and they have observed that in the different yeast now you have insertion of 94 nucleotide here, 119 here, 103, 106, and so forth in the different yeasts. If you put back on the phylogeny here, you would see that this insertion occurs primarily in this loop and the, this end and this end. Of course, none of the insertion will target the active center, but as you might expect, because all of these RNA molecules are essential. They are always peripheral, but we see very long insertion. This one can be up to 100 nucleotides, this one can be up to 600 nucleotides long. And in fact, if you put it back on the phylogeny here, you will see that these yeasts have relatively short insertion. These yeasts to have much longer longer insertion. So there is a phylogenetic relationship between the different kinds of insertion. We have no idea how the insertions are made. They are always peripheral for functional reasons, but how they are created. If you look at the sequence of the insertion themselves, again, they look like nothing else. They are just there, but how they are formed, we have no idea. Okay, final point, the tRNA genes. This is just a long list of counting tRNA genes for every tRNA species and so forth. The only point to remember here is we have between 160 something tRNA genes to up to 500. And we have 42 to 44 tRNA species. Okay, this is published, so just it's right here. We have been studying what happens to the tRNA genes in terms of decoding strategy and in terms of copy number variation and the like. The thing is, well, it's a complicated slide made by my colleague Christian Marc, but I'll try to go through it and not be confused. Here are the yeasts. Here are the events we have. Again, remember, 42 to 44 different tRNA copies exist in each species. Okay. The reason the number is slightly lower than in all other eukaryotes is because they use pairing rules, which are not exactly the same. For example, for the arginine codon or the leucine codon, they use a sparing rule such that the base in position 34 of the tRNA molecule can base pair with the third base of the codon in this way or in this way and so forth. Okay, this is what has happened here is that the sparing rule for arginine has changed in this particular position of the tree. Therefore, all of these yeasts are using the eukaryotic type of decoding, the genetic code, and all of these yeasts are using the bacterial type of decoding the genetic code. Okay, for what is the nature of the event, we don't know, but it is clearly an event in which the tRNA has been changed such as to read U, C, and A instead of only U and C, whereas this other tRNA reads only G and not A and G. Okay. The second event which has occurred in this branch, but not in this branch, is another sparingo, whatever, where is it? Here. Same kind of ID, but for the leucine codon. This tRNA reads U, C, and A instead of this one reads C and G, okay? At this particular point here. Has occurred at this particular point here. At this particular point here, the normal eukaryotic type of reading is still preserved for the leucine codon. But then, at this particular point here, in this branch, it has switched back to the normal eukaryotic type. Okay, that's happened only in this line, nowhere else. And then, these two points here, they have been a functional acquisition of tRNA molecule with different charging properties. For example, here, tDNA arginine, CGG, is in fact, has been recruited out of a tDNA aspartic, GTC, and at this point, the tDNA aspartic has been used to charge arginine, and this is true for all of these yeasts. At this point, here on this line, same thing for tDNA methionine and threonine. Okay.
What kind of mutations do you need at the DNA level to get these changes in sparing rules?
I don't think it's a mutation. It's an A34 on the tRNA molecule. It's a secondary modification, chemical modification of tRNA molecule. Okay. It is always an A34 in both cases. Okay. But it is modified. Okay, it is chemically modified. Okay.
So in bacteria, we know that an A is an I, becomes an
yes,
I.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So this one should be an I. An I, yeah. Absolutely.
Can we not, and the thing that's very peculiar is that it's only an arginine.
Yeah. In this particular case, yes. Yes. But here we have it in the leucine codon, the CUN leucine codon as well. Yeah?
Which never occurs in bacteria.
Yeah?
The thing I know, but I don't know why, is why you get that A in the arginine in bacteria and you don't get it anywhere else.
Yeah.
So what I didn't know is that you now get it somewhere else in the yeast.
Well, we get it in some of the yeast, not all, okay? And we have reconstructed the whole story with a parsimony hypothesis. What is the most parsimonious way of putting this event? Okay, this was the...
So, other than changes to the enzyme that makes this modification?
I suspect, yes, but I don't think I know exactly that, but I suspect this is what happens. The chemical modification, the modifying enzyme of tRNA have been changing. Possibly because these enzymes themselves are the result of horizontal gene transfer, something like that. That's a possibility, I don't know. But okay. Okay, so this is the story of the reading. Now, what we have discovered in yeast, and we are quite surprised, is that we find quite often two tDNA which are separated next to each other. They're normally distributed all over the genome, okay? Very rarely, very few clusters are found. Only Yarovia has a few, but the others are distributed. But we find in every yeast, almost every yeast, pairs of tDNA separated by a few nucleotides, very small, usually 3 to 15 nucleotides. No trace of POL3 terminator. Usually a beautiful trace of POL3 terminator here there. Okay. And we discovered that in yeast. We look at the literature, it was mentioned before. There was one case described in Cerevisiae before. There was one case, if I'm correct, in S. Pombe also described. Since then, other cases have been described in plants. So there are other cases like that. What we have also found more recently is the same structure with an upstream tDNA molecule, few nucleotides, no terminator, and another POL3 RNA molecule. I will show you an example of that. Okay. We have also found a case in which we have a triplicate or single case. Three. Okay, we have two tDNA molecules and another POL3 RNA molecule next to a single case like this. It was shown in a few cases that we have a primary transcript diacyst tronic, which is then cleaved into two RNA molecules. It was shown for some tDNA, and it was shown extensively for this construct recently. Okay. So it looks as if POL3 gene likes to make diacystronic transcript. Okay. And if, when we look at them in, through the whole story of the yeast, we see interesting things. The fusion arginine TCT aspartic GTC, this is the anticodon here, okay. The fusion is found in nearly all of these yeast, except these two. So the parsimony hypothesis suggests that the fusion has occurred at this branch and has been secondarily lost in these two. Okay. So similarly, the arginine TCT phenylalanine GAA has occurred here and is found in these two yeast. Okay. For all of the fusion, they are always lineage specific. Isoleucine, glutamine, histidine, valine. Here is a huge series of arginine, histidine, valine, leucine, valine, serine, aspartic, threonine, threonine, and so forth. And if you look at all of them, they're always different. Okay? So as if there's a dynamic of fusing diacystronic POL3 transcript in all lines and creating different types of fusion. Okay? This is what we have. In many cases, the fused copies are themselves amplified. Two, five, we have up to six copies of the fused tDNA, identical tDNA fusion. We don't know why. In most cases, there is a freestanding tRNA, which is, there are freestanding tRNA available for both members. In some cases, there is simply no freestanding tRNA. The old tRNA of, say, I forget the details, but old tRNA of histidine in this particular strain will be only found in the fusion. No, there is no freestanding gene in somewhere else in the genome. Okay. Here is an example of the POL3 transcript recently published. This is in press, but I think it's out now. tDNA upstream is found fused to a few nucleotides. Confused to a 5S RNA gene. Now you have to realize if you are familiar with eukaryotes, 5S RNA genes are dispersed in eukaryotic genomes, except for yeast, where they are usually, well, they're always in the rDNA repeats, okay? Except for yeast. Within the yeast, Yarovia lipolytica is the exception, is a eukaryotic type organism in which the 5S RNA is not in the rDNA repeat. Okay. So they are dispersed, there's something like 109 genes dispersed throughout the genome, as it is for almost all eukaryotes. Out of them, half of them, 48, are found in fusion, and they are found in fusion with a variety of tRNA upstream. Most often, they are found in fusion with the glycine tRNA. 28 copies of the 30 glycine tRNA of Yarovia are in fusion with 5S. Then they are found with aspartic tRNA, 8 copies of 28. With glutamic tRNA and some cases of glutamine, threonine, and lysine, glucine, as I mentioned. So the fusion are organ of all variety. They are always, very often they are multiplied, 28 copies of this one, 8 copies of this one, 9 copies of this one. The intergenic distance is quite small, 4, 5, 7 nucleotides. So, and these people have shown directly that the transcript is diacystronic. Okay, so. It is not in these 4, 5 nucleotides. It is the structure of the tDNA itself which is recognized and cleaved properly. Okay. Same thing for the if it is where tDNA. Same thing for the 5' RNA. Okay. So it doesn't matter what is inside. In fact, 0 nucleotide would be probably acceptable. Okay.
So what's around P?
Yeah. Yeah, and SP is a five prime cleavage. The RNA is what is it called? Z is a 3' cleavage. There's another, what's the name of the other RNA? There's another RNA for 3' cleavage. Yeah. Well, both big. If you have two DNA, you have both five prime and 3' cleavage. Okay. So this is tronic. Transcript fusion occurs in almost every yeast. If you look carefully on my drawing, we have not found this is tronic transcript for this one and for this one. Besides that, I forgot this one, but this one add. Besides that, we have found this histonic transcript everywhere. Okay. They are not conserved between species except for some few cases. They are often amplified in several copies scattered throughout genomes. And they always involve the upstream gene is always a tRNA gene, but the downstream gene is a variety of POL3 transcript. There is one report right now of a tRNA microRNA fusion in plant, if I am correct. There is one report of that same type of structure in which tRNA is now linked to a microRNA, another type. So is there a function for that? We don't know. How it is formed? We don't know. And whether it contributes to anything in genome evolution? We don't know. So that's what we understand right now. We are doing experiments because we don't like to have not knowing. We are doing a few experiments. One of the experiments which is underway, we have already replaced the tRNA synthetase equivalent tRNA synthetase from both the yeast. They don't like it. In most cases, they die. But this is what we like. In some cases, we have extremely weak cells. They have a division rate of more than 24 hours. They make tiny colonies after 2 weeks of incubation. So they don't like it, which is what. But we have swapped tRNA synthetase, a variety of tRNA synthetase, the one which are in single nucleotide chain. We have swapped them between Yarovia lipolytica and Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and they really don't like it, but some of them survive. So we are trying to do experiments like that to see whether we can select for the either fusion or other type of amplification or something. Okay. So at this, I think this is time to go to lunch. Now everything beyond this point is absolutely, I'm not responsible. It's just wild speculation. Okay, how goes evolution? We have some idea of evolutionary clock. Vertebrate is relatively clear. I assume, yesterday I told you this was only a question mark. My own estimate, this would be of the order of 10 to the minus 7 for a variety of reasons, roughly 2 logs quicker. Otherwise it doesn't work. Otherwise it makes yeast have been separated before the origin of the universe and it does not work. So and there is a number of experimental results saying that this figure is probably of the right order of magnitude. We have seen that genetic map rearrange and synteny is destroyed with time. As a rule of the thumb, synteny between 100% and 80% is clearly seen between related organisms among the Drosophila or among the protoploid yeast. Synteny much below is seen between distantly related organisms. Redundancy is a signature of genomes because they are built out of redundancy. And I have said yesterday, non-duplicated yeasts have redundancy ratio of 1.2, 1.3. And everything above that is either because there was duplication or specific family expansion. And finally, novel genes in vertebrates, some of them are formed out of RNA-mediated events. In yeast, we find satellite horizontal gene transfer NUPS as in vertebrate. But So far, no RNA mediated event except this very strange RNA expansion. Okay, if I want to summarize, we still have a lot of surprise. I know this is a whole group of theoretical biologists or theoretical physicists, theoretical biologists here. In fact, when we do experiment, we have a lot of surprise. So we are still very far in the Middle Ages. And therefore, it's nice to do modelization, but we don't have to, should not forget that if you look at nature, it is not as we have predicted. First of all, the first surprise was the big evolutionary divide between the yeast, and I've said that several times. But we have the other thing. Tandem genarase, we have no idea why this yeast likes to do tandem genarase. Okay. Mega satellite, we have no idea what this is. Well, we have some idea, but we were observing mega satellite in this particular fusion of 5S tRNA in this one. Okay, why? Here we find in this one, accidentally, that the genome is heterogeneous. I will show you an example just shortly. All of the genome are homogeneous in composition except that one. And there was no way to predict that. Okay. We just came across that by accident. Here we find, this one you have never seen, because we just finished the sequence of that one, but we find an interesting mosaic of hybrid, which is a structure which is probably very meaningful in terms of evolution. In fact, the genome is same size as the others, except that it is partly a hybrid between two distinct parents and partly homozygous one type or the other. Okay, so it tells us probably a lot of things, but we, if we did not decide to sequence this one, we would have never thought that this could exist. And then, just because we want more surprise, we are now finished that sequence of this one here, which is supposed to branch somewhere here, but there's a big question mark. It's somewhere here, but we don't know anything of this particular yeast, so we expect for more surprise. Just the compositional heterogeneity I mentioned is the following. This one I can talk because we have more data. Here is zygote Saccharomyces fruxi. This is a different chromosome, like one after another. You see the GC percent is very homogeneous all across the genome with low GC percent, about 40%. The same is for this one. We have GC richer yeast, such as this one here, for example, slightly more noisy, and same here. And we have one case like this, in which you see that one megabase of the third chromosome is clearly rich C rich, whereas the rest of the genome is 40% GC. Okay. It's not expected. There are two other cases in literature. They are all in diatoms. No, that one in diatoms, one in a green algae. Okay, they are published. And the author, well, they are published in Nature. They have said, we have that sort of heterogeneity. We have no idea what it means. They made a Nature paper. So I think I will send that to Nature and say, we also don't know what it means. Actually, we know a little bit more. It's just the zoom of this thing. It just coincides more or less with the left arm, except for three genes. So this centromere, three genes, and then the GC composition. We have now run experiment. It appears as if the reason why the GC is higher here is because this piece of chromosome is desynchronized versus everything else in the genome during the S phase of the replication phase. This piece is clearly made only of late replication origin. And this is a coincidence. It's beautiful. We have made a time course experiment across the S phase, and it's absolutely beautiful. By which mechanism the fact that they are replicated late makes them GC rich, we don't yet know. But in fact, there's a complete correlation between the mode of replication and the homogeneity and non-homogeneity of the chromosomes. Interestingly, this part of the of the sequence here, if I go here, well, slightly this part here, is the longest syntonic block with this one here. It has 400 genes, which are exactly in the same order. This one is perfectly homogeneous in composition. This one is a heterogeneous part in composition, but they are 300 genes of perfect synthesis. So they have not been reshuffled of any sort. They have the same parents. They have everything. But in this particular species, they have decided to replicate late for some kind of obscure reason.
Okay. Perhaps mean that the recombination rate is quite different?
And that we don't know yet for this one. That we don't know. One thing that we know, that this is completely devoid of all trace of LTRs. So the TY elements never jump into that, whereas they are everywhere else in the genome, but not in this one megabase. Okay. Maybe there is something there as well to study further. Okay, now to finish, this time, 19th century, the fungi were here among the plants, botanical school. We are here as it should be on the top of the world, okay? We are now together with fungi in this part of the tree. and all animals are there, and the yeast are there, and we are called opisthokonts. This is our name now. And if I want to finish that, I have a wild speculation from the ancestral opisthokont. We are very primitive and they are extremely evolved. Okay. From the ancestral opisthokont. And there are several reasons for that. First of all, because the number of generations is much higher for them than what we have from the common ancestor. That is absolutely, absolutely clear. But in addition to that, we have kept all of the primitive, everything which is primitive in terms of RNA-mediated event, retrogene, exon shuffling, RNA control, retropodon, we have all of that. Okay, they have lost almost all of that. And they are probably trapped in an irreversible cycle of evolution. With time, intron decrease, number of introns decrease everywhere with time. That's true for beautiful papers by Wally Gilbert and others on that. So the number of introns decrease. But there is a point beyond which if you lose too many of the introns, then you lose all of this machinery of recreating novel sequences based on the jumping of novel DNA sequences into the intron. So you are stuck into the fact that you will duplicate genes. You will lose genes, you will sometimes get horizontal transfer, pieces of mitochondrial DNA, and a lot of that, but not so many novel genes will be created. So I think this is the reason why they are still yeast after this extremely long evolutionary track. They are still almost the same because they cannot do anything else. They have lost the RNA high control somewhere irreversibly. And they still live with that, okay? The way this is probably why the RNA expand, double-stranded RNA expand, because there is nothing to control them anymore. So this is what they can do in terms of evolution. So I like this view of evolution going from the top down to the bottom. I think it's great. It's just a new feeling from 21st century, how things are progressing. We have numerous examples of that today. So, I will stop. I have to give some credit to the people who are doing the work. The Genolovir Consortium is a CNRS consortium. Jean-Luc Soussier from Strasbourg is a coordinator. Michel Legge, Philippe Barret, Monique Bolotin, Claude Gaillardin, Christian Marc, Vichin Vedelovsky, Rivestov, David Sherman, Pascal Durins, those are collaborators of Genolovir. Most of the sequences are done by Genoscope, and this is the one I mentioned, our final assembled clean yeast sequence. Some of them are done by Genopole Institute Pasteur, and you have seen a picture of some of the people from my lab. Thank you. So.
have some local RNAs like active neurons binding to messenger RNAs?
No, there is no RNA. There is no RNA.
No, but in bacteria you don't have RNA.
No. There is nothing that we know. No, the 3' UTR RNA history we don't have. Okay. Whether we have other RNA, I would not. We don't have any case of transacting cases. We have case of short upstream reading frame in front of the real reading frame, which makes a switch and regulation. Yeah, we have something like that. But transactive, so far not. Maybe there are some, but.
So on the downhill graph we just had, wouldn't losing most of those things be advantageous to be selling anyway in the short term?
Those are all
things which screw up your genome, right?
Yeah.
Presumably, they do more harm than good at the short.
Yeah, on the short time scale, but there is a big gap. You can go either one way or the other, but you will never be in between. We have gone the way of very slow reproduction, small number of population, despite the fact that human beings are a little bit too many, but usually small, well, equivalent to 15,000 people. This is our genetic diversity. They are going the way of very quick exponential clonal growth. For any time they can define food, they just grow on it, expand on it. And so they want to grow extremely quickly, take as much food as they can, then die, and one in billions or whatever is a survivor and will make the next generation. So it's a very different way of doing things. We are stuck with sex, so we cannot reproduce without sex. Not all animals do that. It is very stupid if you think of it. It is a very inefficient process, okay? Most of the case, they lose sex. They just grow clonal as much as they can, because that way they expand in the ecological niche and make as many cells as they can, and eventually they can go to sex from time to time. It is estimated in Cerevisiae the outcrossing is 1 in 50,000, mating is only outcrossing. So they tend not to do too much sex because it is not efficient in terms of growth, in terms of expansion. So they are in a different, very different way. So what is advantageous for one may be disadvantageous for the other, and vice versa. That, I think that's what it is. So losing intron, losing retroposon, losing all everything, if you want to go quickly and do nothing else, probably advantageous at this point. But of course, your future is not as bright. You remain yeast forever.
You didn't say a lot about introns, but the ones that do persist are almost all in like ribosomal genes.
Half of them are in ribosomal protein coding genes. Half of them. Not all ribosomal protein genes have introns, but roughly half of them. They are slightly different in terms of length and blah, 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 blah. They are not always conserved between the different yeasts, actually. So there is a number of them which are there. It's usually believed that the introns are there for the very highly expressed gene. We have, for example, one of the best expressed gene in Cerevisiae is PGK3, the phosphoglycose kinase, and this is a huge amount of that. There are three genes, three polypeptide chain, extremely highly expressed, and they have introns. So I think it has something to do with when you need a lot of expression, you tend to conserve the introns. If you don't need a lot of expression, you can lose or don't lose, it doesn't matter.
So how
do
they
now illustrate? Sorry.
But mechanistically, like
just a molecular biology
perspective.
The point is, this there was this model by Jerry Fink 25 years ago saying that because the yeast has so few introns, because of the yeast genes are actually retro genes,
right.
Which is one possibility, but they have. In this case, there have been many retro genes before the TY elements were lost, which is possible, which is a possibility. Maybe there is something else. It's difficult to lose an intron, except for retrograde information. Okay, so that's what everybody believes. But it may be that in the old path here, they have lost lot of, all of them have lost a lot of their intron. So it was done before, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering because I've heard also that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of in the ribosomal genes which are highly expressed. Yeah. They say they can be these very highly expressed genes.
Yeah.
Whether or not there may be just some mechanistic reason having to do with RNA stability or processing that these very highly expressed ones.
Well,
as opposed to some kind of.
Why is it that difficult to lose an intron? Why is it more difficult to lose an intron? No. If you lose an intron, you want to lose it precisely because otherwise your gene is a mutant. So.
But the same with losing any piece of sequence, you chop out too much.
Yeah, but one efficient way of losing introns is RNA splicing. So it's remove the intron. So this is 100% efficient and it's proper. It will be at the right place.
No, but there are these intron retention events, right? I mean, you get these things where sometimes the intron is spliced out, sometimes.
Yes, we have.
So you could make a short intron and maybe it's spliced in and maybe you have some extra amino acids now that don't do much.
Yeah, we can do a lot of that. We have a non-complete splicing for quite a number of intron genes, actually. So a number of intron genes are not 100% spliced. And so there's one possibility there. You can delete at the DNA level, but it sounds less efficient than using the.
Why don't you get rid of splicing machinery altogether?
Oh, in Siberia, this is lethal.
Evolutionary.
Yes, you could probably think that maybe further down we will have lost the splicing machinery altogether. That's a possibility. Actually, there is Jeff Booker is resynthesizing a new yeast, artificial by chemical synthesis. He's doing that right now. One of the things that he may want to do is synthesize it without any intron. We don't need that, okay? Synthesize the complete yeast genome without any introns and without splicing machinery and see what happens. He may be doing something like that. If you want to do it from the status being. By classical method, it will take forever. The removal of the intron will be too long. Okay, it will be 250 serial experiments, so it's a too long experiment. It's better to synthesize it chemically.
Is there any alternative for splicing?
There is few described here and there. First of all, very few genes have two introns. That's number one. What is called alternative splicing is in fact incomplete splicing. The intron can be there or not there. We do have a few cases of alternative splicing in which one exon is optional, not the other. Primarily in Yarovia and the variomyces. There's not so many elsewhere, but there is no place to see it. Yeah.